ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यममृतात्। 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 ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यममृतात्।
Good afternoon and good evening and welcome to our fourth meeting, our fourth Sangam on the path of living and dying. So There's just a couple of housekeeping things I want to say here at the beginning before we chant and do our first meditation. And one of them is that Jackie Robb, who's participating in this class and who works with dying people and has a lot of expertise in this field, has very kindly created a set of handouts that are now up on the class webpage, which include a checklist of the signs that someone is approaching death, a checklist of some of the things that we need to prepare ourselves and have discussions about around this topic, some suggested readings, and quite a few other materials that I really recommend you're looking into. And she also has a couple of book recommendations, some of which are also included on the book list that you can find there. For the practical issues that have come up or are coming up for many of you around the illnesses and coming death of parents and friends and loved ones, this is some very, very valuable material. So thank you, Jackie, and I hope you take advantage of it. Let's begin now with our opening aspiration prayer, our formal aspiration prayer, and with the recognition of our shared presence here. Let's take a deep breath, big inhalation, expanding the belly, and then a long exhalation. And remember, as you exhale, draw the belly in towards the spinal column, which helps expelling the old air. And with the inhalation, feel that you're receiving the energy of all the different teachers and guides and angelic forces, all those beings who are gathered around and literally showering us with grace from moment to moment. So let yourself draw that in with the inhalation, and then with the exhalation, just simply let go of whatever you're carrying from the day, as much of the tension, nervousness, worry, fear, just unknown, uncomfortable feelings that might be present. So again, inhaling with a sense that you're drawing in grace. Exhale with a feeling that you're letting go of stuff, of schmutz, of whatever feels distracting or unpleasant. And once again, with this exhalation, I like to do, without thinking of anything in particular, just a general instruction to myself on the exhalation. Just let go. Relax. Maybe relax has a tendency to bring up its opposite, but at least for me, let go has a very easeful connotation. So as you draw in the sense of grace, let yourself be aware of our presence here together, which is spread across the globe, and which I like to imagine as a succession of little flames, soul flames. You know, the soul is often described and seen in the form of a flame. Feel the presence of all of us sitting together wherever we are, whatever time zone we're in, and whenever we happen to be listening to this class. We're all here on the subtle level together, pretty much throughout this process, no matter what time we tune in. And I just want to say, this is a mystery to me, but I've experienced it so many times that I know it's true. With this sense of the presence of all of us here, just imagine yourself lighting your candle and placing it in the center of this virtual circle. And please join me in this aspiration prayer, which was included in your homework if you happen to have it and would like to read it, or you can just say it silently or out loud after me. Inhaling, may what we're about to do give beneficial results. Exhaling, may it give us the power to be of real benefit to others. Inhaling, may it help us overcome our negativities and delusions. Inhaling and exhaling. Exhaling with, may what we are about to do clear away obstacles on our path. And may it propel us to a future state of enlightenment. And in making this aspiration, we understand that we draw that future state, which may include joy, stillness, light, global awareness, freedom, surrender, every form of benevolence. We draw that future state into our circle and into our lives. And with all that in mind, we offer our conversation this evening for the benefit of all sentient beings. And now let's find a posture. If you've lost it, find a strong, upright, comfortable posture. And if you're walking, you can do the first part of this practice walking. And we'll chant, first of all, the Mrityunjaya, the Mahamrityunjaya mantras, and then Om Namah Shivaya Gurave, and we'll chant along with our great singers whom Deb is queuing up for us right now.
Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanam Mrityor Mukshyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanam Mrityor Mukshyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshyam Amritat. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave.
Feel the connection of your sit bones to the seat, the heaviness of your buttocks, your thighs, and feel how with the next inhalation, you sense the grounding and the connection of your body to the earth that supports you. With the exhalation, feel as though the breath moves up through the body, uncoiling the spinal column very slowly and gently up through the crown. Inhale and feel the shoulder blades release onto the back. Exhale and sense the chest lift and open. Become aware of the presence of the vertical axis that runs from the base of the body all the way up through the crown, just inside, just in front of the spinal column. And you may sense this slender axis as being the size of a wire, very slender, or quite wide, taking up the whole space of your inner body. And you begin now to sense the inhalation flowing in from above the crown, perhaps even sensing the presence of the energy of deity, the energy of great sage over your crown, over your head. Perhaps a presence that feels more masculine, perhaps more feminine, perhaps simply it's a sense of presence or beingness or light. And with the inhalation, the light of that higher realm flows in through your crown and begins to flow down your body towards the base. And with the exhalation, you allow the breath to draw your consciousness upward, perhaps up through the heart into the third eye center in the head, or perhaps higher up into the region beyond the crown. And allow that vertical breath to both draw in light and presence from above, and then to draw your awareness upward through the center of the body, allowing it to release and merge into the higher chakras, which open us also to the higher realms. And with your inhalation, allow the breath to flow in with the thought, Namah. And with the exhalation, Shivaya. As thoughts arise, notice them and breathe them out with the exhalation. Just allow yourself to settle more and more deeply into the vertical flow of the breath, the sense of light flowing into your body, and the mantra. And as you begin to emerge, just take a moment to be aware of that cognizing, knowing, recognizing even part of your mind field that we call awareness, that part of you that knows that you're sitting, that knows what's going on in your body, that knows your thoughts, that knows you're listening. Just tune in, as we will be doing periodically, to awareness, to the knower, to the looker, to that wordless spaciousness that shows up when you ask yourself a question, what's looking, what's hearing, what's knowing? What is it that experiences myself as an I-ness, as a being? What is it that lets me experience all this? Not looking for an answer in words, of course, just using the question as a way of tuning into what it is that's ever-present, literally non-dual, connecting all of us. So last week we spoke about karma, and this week, especially on the listserv, we've been receiving so many very beautiful expressions of how people are metabolizing what I call karmic regrets or karmic memories, especially with parents. I guess because this is the time of life when our parents are starting to leave the planet, although for many of us that happened a while ago, but it's very much a part of our experience now. And one of the things that I find when I'm reading through your posts, your writings, is that with all the beautiful uniqueness, there's such a universal experience that's being shared. And also, one of the things that I become aware of is how within the collective mind field of this Sangham, all of these experiences are actually being processed so that in a certain sense, we get to hold awareness not only of our own memories, our own insights, but also of each other's. And in a certain sense, it's one of the ways that we experience in daily life, especially in the internet age, that basic message of the Vedanta texts, that the world we experience is appearing within awareness. It's appearing in a kind of virtual space, and of course our virtual space is electronic, but in fact the virtual space is much subtler than that. And once we start to have some glimpses of awareness itself, of the pure mind, Chaitanya, the undivided self, it begins to make more and more sense to us to recognize that whatever is occurring, including the so-called outside world, is also appearing within awareness. You know, in Vedanta, the parables and the teachings reiterate this again and again and again. The world is within the mind, within the great mind, within the mind of God, Source, you know, pure consciousness, but in a very immediate way that is not entirely understandable when we first hear it, but becomes more and more understandable the more we hold it. It's also occurring in our own mind. As we keep entering into awareness of awareness in different ways, this becomes easier to understand. And it also in terms of dealing with our karmas, with our life, it so makes so much difference in the way we're able to approach our experience. I still hold, it's one of my major, let's call it spiritual memories, a memory of the first time that I actually found myself in pure awareness. And it happened in a workshop quite a few years ago, and which I had attended with three friends, one of whom was the most triggering person I knew at the time. He was really brilliant and incredibly sarcastic, and he had this ability to just sort of zero in on other people's vulnerabilities, especially mine, or at least that's how it felt. So being around him was always felt tricky. And the thing I remember about coming out of this experience where I had fully sensed my real nature as presence, as light, as clarity, as completely untouched by, you know, the various neuroses of my mind. There he was with my other two friends, and as we went to lunch and engaged in conversation, I discovered that nothing he said bothered me. I was free of it. I was free of it because my major part of my awareness was in presence, was in awareness. And it was literally, I think, my first real glimpse of what it feels like to be free in a complex social situation. I also saw that when I was in that state then and in the, you know, always from then till now, my actions and words are not only come from a different place, but create a very different karmic footprint, if you will, than happens ordinarily. So this week, and you know this, almost all of you have had moments like this, and many of you have many moments where you just see through the maya of your supposed identity, your role, and the way you think things should be. And so from that perspective, as we're going to speak more deeply about the different subtle worlds that we visit after death, consider how they might be affecting our experience right now, I'd like to ask you to continue kind of folding back into awareness of awareness from time to time, and we'll do some other contemplations. But the material we're going to be looking at is really pretty out there. It's been seen in different ways by people of different cultures. It certainly looks different according to your stage of consciousness. And it is very much a meme. You know, I know you all know the word meme because it's such a big term in our culture. But these days we've come to associate meme with, you know, cat photos and cartoons of Pepe the Frog that are shared on the internet. But if you remember a meme, it's a term that was coined by Richard Dawkins, the scientist. A meme is a kind of a mental, he uses the word gene, you know, G-E-N-E. It's a mental quality which encompasses a worldview or a way of seeing that actually spreads virally. I won't give you examples because they're all sort of social examples, but you know, for example, each one of us is living within memes and within worldviews that affect everything. And one example that is very obvious is that if you're walking down the street in, say, London, and you see a woman wearing lipstick and high heels and a bare-shouldered dress, which she probably wouldn't be doing at this time of year. But in any case, if you're a Westerner, normally secular, non-religious Westerner, you will look at her and you'll just go, okay, woman. And you might be aware of, you know, her age, her appearance, maybe her social class. If you're a conservative Muslim and you look at that woman, a whole other set of memes comes into operation, including perhaps a desire to look away, not to see an uncovered woman. Those are good examples of how memes sort of act as filtration systems for us. And the views we have of the body and the afterlife are very much part of a mimetic structure that influences everything about our life, really. When we start talking about the astral planes and the different astral worlds, one of the questions that may come up for some of you is, do I really need this right now? You know, especially because you may be more concerned with navigating the terrain of your personal life, of your karmic situation, of very practical issues that have to do with life and death. You know, also if you have a kind of general non-dual attitude, you may think, well, these are just thought forms. They're not necessarily important to pay attention to. So I want to just give you a couple of ways to listen to what we're going to say. One of the reasons to pay attention to this conversation about astral worlds is simply because all of us, if we haven't already experienced some form of them, very probably will in the future. And the way we are able to understand these realms is going to affect the way we experience them. It's going to affect whether we feel scared or put off or inflated or any number of other reactions. Another reason, which is a bit more esoteric, but which is very much my experience, is that when we begin to contemplate subtle realities, we also begin to recognize the creative capacity that we have to bring such subtle fields into our normal, ordinary daily existence. Many of you have this experience when you've meditated deeply that, you know, you open your eyes and the world around you feels different, looks different, and even is, you know, is experienced differently by others. The ability to recognize the presence of subtle realms also over time begins to give you the ability to literally draw these realms into the physical world. And, you know, if you've ever been in for instance, a very powerful ashram or holy place, or even at your own altar, you may recognize how there is a kind of purity of environment, purity of mental psychic space around such places. And one reason for it is because in such places, we contemplate the very subtle sacred aspects of reality, and so they begin to be part of our physical world. So those are some reasons why this is important. Then another one, of course, is to open our minds to the existence of, as in the famous line in Hamlet, there is so much more in this universe than is dreamt of in our philosophy, especially our very materialistic and reductionist philosophy, the meme that underlies the modern world, even for people who don't feel that we live in it. Nonetheless, we all live in the meme that there's one world inside here and another world out there, and that so-called world out there is more real than the world inside. What the sages say is actually that is not true. The descriptions, I'm going to try and give you descriptions of these realms that are more or less attested to by different cultures, different spiritual cultures especially. And in so doing, I'm drawing on Indian sources. I'm particularly drawing on, as I said last week, an account that's in Autobiography of a Yogi. It's the account of a meditation visit that Yogananda had from his guru, Yukteswar. I misidentified who it was last week. It wasn't his guru's guru. It was his guru who had passed on and who was describing to Yogananda, to his disciple, what the subtle realms look like. It's a description that I find extremely compelling and that has not only Shakti, but a quality of being believable. The beings who have tried to convey these realities, which are seen not through the physical eyes, obviously, not even so much through what's sometimes called the eye of mind, you know, the eye of the intellect, but really through the eye of spirit, through faculties that we possess which are non-physical. And these beings have tried to describe these worlds using earth language, which, if you've ever experienced one of these realms, you know is not really capable of being accurate. You know, for instance, the light of the subtle realms, the subtle worlds, is not exactly like the light we experience here. It has a quality of feeling in it. It has an affective quality. It's a kind of intrinsic lovingness that, you know, some Christian and Sufi writers describe it as living light or loving light. It has a kind of a liquid quality to it that sometimes we can feel bathing us. But none of these words really describe what it feels like, what it looks like to be in that realm and see that light. Although, if you've had dreams or meditation experiences where you've sensed it, you know what it's like. But even though these things are hard to describe, some of them carry with them a deep conviction of truth, even if a deep conviction that what you're experiencing is real. One of the reasons that I find the maps so useful is simply because they help us hold experiences that we may not be able to understand or take seriously. So without hosing you down, I just want to provide you with some clues as to what experienced practitioners encounter after leaving the body in death. Let's just settle for a moment. Follow the breath. See if you can follow the breath rather methodically, following the inhalation, just noticing the felt sense of it in the nostrils and in the inner body, and the exhalation. And for 30 seconds, we'll pull back, ask ourselves, what is it that knows I'm breathing? And just notice the space that arises. And hold for a moment the recognition, I am that. That glimpse or immersion in awareness that may have arisen is at least a glimpse of what I most deeply am. Some of this material comes from the testimony of enlightened teachers of the Tibetan tradition, some from teachers of course, the Hindu tradition, and some from the Western metaphysical traditions, including material that has appeared in modern times through hypnotherapists' regressions. And I want you to know that I have a lot of skepticism about visions or insights into past lives that come through hypnotic regression, simply because the world of the citta is so vast and has so much stuff in it that I've always found it hard to discern whether something that comes up for me is an insight into a past life or a karmic cause of something that I've experienced. I really never know whether I'm having a real insight or whether it's something I read in a novel or saw in a movie. But in some of this material, partly because it's attested to from different sources who don't seem to have been in communication with each other. Some of it seems valid to me, so I'm going to at least offer it to you in a, in a kind of a provisional form. And also to realize that everything we're talking about is being mirrored in your own mind and heart. In other words, all this is inside you. And the way you experience them, even the way you hear about them, is going to be, to a certain extent, a projection of your own mind. And if you understand that whatever is occurring in this multi-level cosmos is occurring inside one great mind, and that your own individual mind is a part of that and actually has access to it, then we do begin to understand how when we shift states of consciousness, for example, from the waking state to dream, to dark, dreamless rest, that our experience of ourselves changes radically, and that in only one of these states are we actually in a physical body. So let's assume now that your soul is leaving the body. And let's assume, I'm not going to take you through the process, so we will do it next week. Let's assume that your soul is leaving through one of the higher centers, through the eyes, perhaps, or perhaps even through the crown. To a sensitive observer, as your soul leaves the body, it may be visible as a tiny white or blue light that comes out of your eyes, and this is something that some of you may have seen, or that perhaps seems to flow out with an exhalation that doesn't actually return. And as the soul leaves the body, it enters a subtle world that in Tibetan is called the bardo. The bardo means condition or state, and there are four basic bardos that are spoken of in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, which actually correspond to the four bodies, to the gross body, the subtle body, the causal body, and the supercausal body. So we'll just go through them, and today we're going to do a little bit of discussion of the Tibetan view of the astral world, and then we're going to segue to Sri Yukteswar's vision. So the first of the four bardos is called the natural bardo of life, and we're in it now. Fully awake, with consciousness of the physical world, all our physical senses are functioning. And this is the arena where we make karma, where we live out karma, and also where we practice, which is, as we said last week, the most skillful way of working out our karmas. The second bardo, which a lot of you have been discussing and thinking about in the last few weeks, is called the painful bardo of dying. Obviously, the process of coming close to and coming up to the threshold of dying is pretty darn uncomfortable. This is a state we enter when the dying process begins, and pretty much usually starts, if we're old or very sick, before hospice comes. But it's, you know, one of the skillful things about the hospice movement is that they understand the painful bardo of dying very well, and they're pretty much experts at helping the dying person and their family work with it in the least painful way possible. And many of the books that you can read about death and dying will help you with the practical issues that go on here. The third bardo, which begins when the dying process is complete, and you know, the understanding of it is pretty much, it's one of the great gifts that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition gives us. It's called the luminous bardo of dharmata. Dharma in this context means the realm of absolute truth. And the fourth bardo, which is what we'll be mostly talking about today, is called the bardo of becoming. Now, in the Tibetan teachings on the after-death world, in the bardo todal, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, please forgive my Tibetan pronunciation, Bardo Thodol literally means the pithy instructions on navigating the bardo. We call it the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's actually meant for people who are advanced practitioners and who are prepared to use this moment as a lifetime's opportunity to recognize the true nature of your mind, which can liberate you completely from all karmas and from rebirth. It presents a world, well, I'll get to that in a moment, but the gist of it, and most of you have read this, the gist of it is that at the moment of death, we are shown the luminosity of the great mind, the Dharmata, which is exactly the experience that you may remember from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, where when Krishna reveals to Arjuna a light brighter than 1,000 suns, and Arjuna faints. This is the Dharmata. If you've taken a psychoactive drug trip or medicine journey, especially with ayahuasca or dimethyltryptamine or psilocybin, you may have had a vision of this light, which is above the crown. It is like an incredibly bright sun. And most people who die do not actually see this light, because as the teachers of the tradition tell us, our karmic obscurations, this is a wonderful Tibetan phrase, karmic obscurations. They sometimes use the word defilement. But in other words, the residue of our beliefs, our energy structures, our karmic structures, literally form a cloud that obscures the light. And so what normally happens to the soul in the moment of leaving the body is that it goes into a deep sleep state, a kind of swoon, like Arjuna when he saw the light of 1,000 suns. And what the Bardo Thodol says, however, is that if we blow it, if we're not able to see the light of Dharmata, and if we're not able to merge into it, we have another couple of chances. So by merging into it, what the text means is recognizing this incredibly vast light as the true nature of our own mind. In other words, it's not that your body somehow dissolves into this light. It's that you see, you know, only possible after a lot of meditation, you see that this is you, that you are that light. And that's the moment of instantaneous revelation or instantaneous liberation. So if that doesn't happen, if you miss that moment, what then appears, and I want you to know that what the Bardo Thodol describes is traditional Tibetan religious imagery. So it probably won't look like this to you if you do have this experience. But in the Tibetan religious imagery, what appears at that point is that the vast undifferentiated light differentiates into deities, as many as 100, some of them peaceful and beautiful, some of them wrathful and angry. And if you've seen Tibetan art, you have a sense of what they look like. They're huge. They make a lot of noise. Some of them are beautiful. Some of them are scary. And if you can recognize that these are appearances within your own mind, you can be liberated at that moment. If that's not possible, if you can't recognize that, these deity visions then kind of morph into colored lights which move in a sort of kaleidoscopic fashion. Some of you may have seen this in meditation. And these lights are said to be the lights of the various forms of divine wisdom, of higher wisdom. And again, if you can recognize that these are the lights of your own wisdom mind, again, you can be liberated. So there's three truths that are revealed here, just to point them out. First, that all these realms, all these huge presences are inside your mind. Secondly, that it's all in the process of morphing, of changing, reforming moment by moment. It's never fixed. It's never static. And third is you have a choice. You have choices. So there are choice points where you can go very, very high, very big, very expanded. But they are only available if you've practiced, basically. Otherwise, what happens, and this is what happens to most of us, is that what the Tibetans call the winds of karma, Indian tradition, the Hindu tradition has similar words for it, sort of blow you into the bardo of becoming. That is to say, the astral realms that we're going to talk about. We enter the astral worlds, remember, as a soul. We're without body at this point, though at certain points in this process, we start to recognize that we can create a body, and we do. Again, before we go on, I want to say a little bit about how these traditions speak of the soul, which in Sanskrit, in Indian lore, the soul is called the jivatma, or the individual self. In Buddhism, which doesn't recognize the existence of the self, they talk about it as mind, as a form of mind. The jivatma is your individual, as it were, your individual slice of pure awareness, which you experience as a unique separate consciousness. And this is the core of your individuality. I like to call it the essence, your essence. One of my teacher friends calls it the unique self. And it's fluid, it's evanescent, and it's not limited by the physical body that it incarnates in. So again, physical bodies, we've discussed this earlier, being made of physical elements actually evolve out of the material of the physical world, of the planet, especially the food, the water, the air, the heat that our physical bodies metabolize more or less without our conscious will. Theoretically, a body, and not just in a zombie film, but theoretically a body could function without a soul. And in the five sheaths model of the Indian yoga tradition, the physical body is called the food sheath because it's made entirely of food. Actually, there's no agreement as to whether a physical body can function without a soul, so please scratch that. But at death, what we do know is that the body resolves back into the elements it was made of and becomes food for the microbes and other critters. And this is, including the ashes and the bones left after cremation, and it's then recycled and becomes part of other bodies or part of the planet. But the soul, being non-physical, actually is a subtle energy field or subtle energy bubble that holds within it what we might call the basic software that forms our essential operating system or our innate personal nature, which in Sanskrit is called our prakriti, prakriti meaning the field of experience. And it consists of, if you don't mind a little geek information, it consists of 19 subtle elements, 4 psychic instruments, as they're called, the mind, or in Sanskrit, the manas, which produces thoughts and also filters the experiences that come in through the senses. And it does this with the subtle senses as well as with the physical senses. The intellect, which is the faculty of discernment, and I believe it's the vehicle of conscious choice, both in our physical life and in life beyond. The subtle ego, which we all know, that which tells you that you're me, and the citta, which we spoke about last week, which is the fundamental ground of the whole package of what we are, and which contains the seeds of your karmic impressions. The soul also carries 5 subtle senses of perception, that is the ability to see, hear, taste, touch, and smell, which we use in ordinary life, in dreams and meditation. Also 5 subtle organs of activity, such as the ability to hold or grasp, to move, to have sex, to excrete, and hear, And it carries the subtle elements, subtle form, subtle sound, subtle taste, subtle smell, and subtle touch, you know, subtle solidity, which are the basis of whatever we experience or create in the subtle world. So essentially, we're carrying the materials which will form our actual experience in the subtle world with us. And we also carry them into the physical world, where they form the basis of our experience of the so-called physical elements as well. According to, and I just want to say one more thing, which is I find very crucial and interesting. According to both the Indian and Tibetan traditions, the soul, the jivatma, does not necessarily enter the body at conception. So remember, the soul is utterly non-material. And according to the Garbha Upanishad, which is the teachings on the womb, which is a very interesting little, I think, medieval text from the Vedantic tradition, the soul comes into its new body sometime between the third and seventh month after conception. You can take this with a few grains of salt, but there is some evidence in modern biology that they call it a quickening, you know, where somehow at a certain point the mother actually starts to feel the presence of somebody inside her womb. And once during a question answer with my guru, a woman asked, what are the karmic consequences of having an abortion? And my guru said unhesitatingly that an abortion performed before a woman is 3 months pregnant doesn't affect the soul of the being who was going to take birth, because 3 months into gestation is the earliest that a soul can come into a body. Now, this may happen at different times according to the karmas of an individual, but he was basing it on scripture, and a lot of this is attested to by great sages who can remember their experience in the womb. And I have to say that there were a lot of women in that room who gave huge sighs of relief at being told that their abortions were not necessarily acts of murder, as they might have heard. But the point is here that bodies and souls, though completely connected, are parallel entities of different densities and frequencies. And in several of the traditions, there are teachings that at a certain stage of evolution, we become able to choose a body that helps us work out the karmic issues that we're dealing with at the moment. Let's take a deep breath in and exhale. And another breath in and exhale. Become aware of that which is present to your experience, which knows that you're sitting, that you're breathing. Just for a moment, become aware of awareness. And ask into that awareness, or simply into the realm that opens when your eyes are closed. Ask, can I get a feeling, a felt sense of that within me that we could call essence or soul? Ask if you can have in this moment a sense of who and what you are as a soul, not as pure awareness, but as an individual soul, not necessarily embodied, though currently embodied. Who am I as a soul? And you're asking for really a felt sense not a list of traits, just a sense of the familiarity of your soul presence, your essence presence. As a clue, you might have had an experience of this in a very intimate, wordless moment with another person, where there is a sense of just being in a kind of communion that's not verbal, not sexual, that's free of agendas, where you're both just present, which is what I call essence contact. Can you get a sense of yourself as that? And if this doesn't come immediately or easily, don't worry about it. But I will tell you that if after class you go into your bathroom, look into your eyes in the mirror, and then become aware of the felt sense of presence that will start to emerge after a few minutes. That's one of the ways that we start to get a sense of our essence, our non-physical, non-verbal, individual self, which is fully present, even and maybe especially when we're in these bodies. The soul, which is often described as a kind of a tiny little seed, you know, the size of a sesame seed, usually colored some form of white or yellow gold or blue, it enters into the astral realm, usually into, at least at the beginning, what's sometimes called the lower astral realm. Yukteswar describes, and we mentioned this last week, that there are levels in the astral realms which are not necessarily stacked on top of each other, but which are often described as being like concentric circles, all of them present, you know, almost like parallel universes. There are many, many, many such realms packed into the astral plane. Many of the after-death, you know, the near-death experience accounts talk about moving through a tunnel into a field of light and sometimes being met by people you know on the other side. So this apparently is not an uncommon experience. It is often described as, by Yukteswar himself, as one of the ways that the mind of the individual that creates familiarity in this moment of transition. And it perhaps may be that the souls of people that we knew in this life will take on subtle bodies to meet us there. And one of the things that occurs both before death and immediately after death is the life review, which in the old traditions is usually called the judgment. And my sense is that the way we understand this has really changed since our cultural evolution has moved from a very hard, you know, hard and fast sin and punishment model of life to a much deeper understanding of the fluidity of our karmic circumstances. In the ancient traditions, all the ancient traditions actually, the Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Greeks, the Hebrews, the Hindus, the Buddhists, Christians, the ancestor-focused traditions of the Far East, African, many, many indigenous communities all over the world, judgment is usually seen as an event where we essentially appear before a court. And this is probably the exoteric interpretation. People these days understand that the court of judgment is a metaphor. But as you know, the Christian myth describes the gates of heaven, where we see New Yorker cartoons every couple of weeks in which something is going on at the gates of heaven, where St. Peter judges the souls who get let in or kept out. In Indian mythology, and also it's in Chinese mythology, and I'm pretty sure it's in Tibetan mythology as well, the court is presided over by Yama, otherwise known as Yama Raja, King Yama, whose name means something like the king of good conduct. Yama is, besides being the ruler of the court of death, he's also the arbiter of dharma, of conduct, of righteousness. Of course, the thing that happens in his court is that it's determined whether your karmic behavior has been aligned with the good and true and the beautiful, and you're assigned to an appropriate realm or a new body. In the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the soul of a newly dead person appears in the court of Osiris, where the soul is weighed in a scale against a feather, which I think is such a beautiful metaphor. Obviously, the lighter the soul, the more likely it is to ascend in one way or another. In modern and contemporary accounts of near-death experience and post-death experience, normally what you recognize is that you yourself are the person who reviews your life, or in some of the hypnotic regression between life accounts, there's a guide, or sometimes a little council of guides who helps you debrief your past life. And what people reveal in these accounts is that the insights that come up in the life review often mirror the insights that we've had in life. You know, as in the intuition, many of us, and I myself, you know, have told me that, you know, they would be about to do something, and they would get an intuition. This would be a mistake. I know you know what I'm talking about. Some of you follow the intuition. Some of us don't. I think every time I've gotten into serious trouble with an event, a karmic event in my life, it's almost always included a moment when I went, say no to this one, and I didn't. And again, as you know, as you've been experiencing, what we often see in the life review is a quick, sharp replay of scenes where we've experienced love or connection or some sort of breakthrough, as well as scenes where we've hurt people or situations where we ourselves have been hurt. It's said that one of the events that occurs in these realms is that our subtle bodies get cleansed of the residue of the suffering that we've undergone in the physical world. One account that has stayed with me past life review, a near-death experience and a past life review, was an encounter that the subject had with a homeless man. And in the memory he had of it, he realized that he had been able to actually be with this person with complete essence contact in their conversation, in their interactions, and that he saw that this contact had changed the homeless man's life trajectory in a significant way, and it had also been a powerful moment of karmic reckoning that had also changed his, and that came up as a, you know, one of the markers of his so-called success in this incarnation. As again, I'm sure you know, because it's in all the literature, one of the big questions that comes up in the life review is, have you increased your capacity for love, for oneness with others? Again, let's just take a moment to be with the breath, inhaling and exhaling. And this time, as you exhale, have the thought, let go, open. As you inhale, have the feeling of receiving not only the air and the prana in the air, but the particles of revelation that may want to come to you in our subsequent conversation here. And also, you may notice as you focus on the breath that certain aspects of what's being said may feel uncomfortable, and certain aspects may feel precious, and certain aspects may feel, you know, kind of like whatever. But it's interesting to notice that as well. Yukteswar, in his account of the astral universe, describes it as being made up of many, many subtle vibrations of light and color. So it is not a physical world. It's a world of vibration, of different shades of color. It's often said to be arranged, you know, to be a place where space bends and time bends. So you can find yourself moving through realms in the blink of an eye. And he says he has a very, very nice kind of image of it. He says the astral universe, the subtle universe, is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times larger than the physical world, and that the physical world is suspended beneath the astral world like a basket under a hot air balloon. So the image he gives is that the energy that comes into the physical world is actually coming through the astral realm and into the astral realm from a realm beyond it. Perhaps source itself. Teshwar says that the events that occur on the subtle and the causal planes are actually creating the dense physical worlds, which is a very interesting thing to contemplate. He describes the astral world as having the quality of being like kind of like planets in that they're discrete, and they often have suns and moons and stars much subtler and brighter than the ones here, and that the worlds that he has visited there are incredibly beautiful. They're pristine. They're jewel-like. The climate is, temperate. They're gorgeous realms. And there are, he says, there are millions and millions of astral beings, souls, who are in transition from the physical universe, souls from the human worlds, as well as astral beings, subtle beings who never incarnate on Earth. And these beings are described in many of the traditional literature and many traditions. And he lists them as fairies, animals, which I would say are spirit animals, goblins, ghosts, demigods, and other kinds of spirits, including some that are referred to in the different traditions as gods, or devas, that is, high beings of light who are not God, but who are very powerful, pure beings. These beings live on different astral planes, according to, I guess, their karmic conditions. The Tibetans divide these types of beings into what they call the six realms, which are described as the realm of gods, the realm of animals, demigods, hungry ghosts, the human realms, and the hell realms. All these traditions have punishment realms, though they're never permanent. In the hypnagogic accounts of the astral world, which I'm going to talk to you about because I find them quite intriguing. They're very suited to the mindset of people in the modern, self-help oriented world. These accounts describe different neighborhoods of soul clusters, where once a soul has come into the after-death realm, they are eventually guided to or brought to a peer group of souls whom they've known for a really long time, who are on their level of evolutionary development, because in this view of the afterlife, our time on Earth is seen as part of our learning, a learning process, and the time in between lives is a time when we can sort of debrief about our actions on Earth, what we've learned, decide on what our next, so to speak, lesson is, and whether we want to go back to the earth plane. So in this very modern contemporary vision of the life between lives, which again we have to take with a few grains of salt, one of the things that is described by the subjects who've been through this regression process is that very often members of your peer group, your soul group, incarnate with you, usually not as parents, but as siblings or friends or sometimes spouses, and that there's enormous affection and also absolute transparency between souls in these planes. Everything is known, nothing is judged, but there's a strong intent to help each other evolve. So it sounds like a kind of ideal karmic study group, if you like that kind of thing, which I must say I do. Now, here we get back to the traditional descriptions, and here I'm going to geek out, and I hope you're willing to be with me here. The lowest regions, or the lower regions of the astral world, and let's not see this hierarchically as low bad, high good. You know, it's a complex environment. But in any case, the lower regions of the astral world are very close to us. And according to Yukteswar, they're crowded with different kinds of spirits. Some of them guides, you know, beings who are available at levels where they can be extremely accessible to people on Earth. Some of them are ghosts or restless spirits of different kinds, as they say, disincarnate spirits who become attached to particular places in the physical world. And this includes the realm of what the Tibetans call the hungry ghosts. And apparently the biggest factor in getting caught in a sort of a ghost form or a hungry ghost form, which is obviously not desirable, is when you die with strong, unprocessed disappointments and resentments, which will tend to keep us hanging around in situations that we're unhappy or angry about. And it's sometimes said that people who die violently go through a period of wandering in this realm, and this is why it's so helpful for our relatives and friends, when, you know, especially when we've died in an accident, as my brother did, to tune into the soul, tell them they're dead, you know, offer them love and remind them to move on. It's apparently very, very effective. The hungry ghost body is seen as a body where the belly is distended because there's no nourishment coming in, but the neck is so narrow that nothing can get through it. And, you know, I think you recognize, as I certainly do, that we all have a hungry ghost within us, usually desperately trying to get the love we didn't get in early childhood, though, you know, it through some form which somehow never satisfies the original craving until we look at it in some way, metabolize and heal it. And our addictions, our eating disorders, our neediness in relationships are all part of the hungry ghost part of the psyche. And, you know, again, in understanding the way the astral realms work, it's very helpful to recognize the ways in which every part of these realms is inside us. So let's just take a moment and consider our own hungry ghost. I'm not suggesting you get too caught up in him or her, but just ask, okay, where does my hungry ghost get hooked? And here I'm talking about this, where is the sense of lack? Where is the neediness that you try to satisfy through a substance of some kind? Feel into that feeling, the disappointment and resentment that's part of that. And just imagine yourself wrapping that hungry ghost part of you in a blanket of acceptance and tenderness. You know, as if you could shower this part of your psyche with the love and affection that it most deeply needs. almost as though your hungry ghost part is a child who is in a certain sense longing for the nourishment of your love. And just see what you can offer her or him in this moment. And with the thought, I offer peace, I offer healing, I offer love to you who are a part of myself. And if this felt big, if this felt really big, imagine offering the hungry ghost presence to the power of Shiva above you, the power of Goddess at your back. Just realize that the light beings who hold you and protect you are absolutely available for this practice of seeing and holding our hungry ghost when she appears, when he appears. So now to get into the weeds, ghosts are also genuine entities that exist and that some people, including me, have felt from time to time. Many years ago, I got to know a woman who has a sixth sense, like in the film, The Sixth Sense. And in other words, she sees spirits. Specifically, she sees ghosts, the ghosts of people who haven't been able to move on, which nobody else can really see. But she's told me that she'll sometimes pass a house in her hometown and see a face looking at her out from a window, sometimes beckoning her, and it'll be someone who's died there. And she has actually, on occasion, gone into one of those houses and worked with the spirit. So many people come to her for help with relatives. She basically hangs out with these restless spirits for a little while, helping them move on. It's also something that tribal shamans will do in their own communities. And in India, it's the custom for people to have small fire ceremonies, havans as they're called, in which offerings are made for the soul of the being who's died and specifically to help them move on. And the relatives and friends will give in charity, especially feed people. Give away food or pay for, a day's meal at a homeless shelter is a way that we sometimes do it, as a way of offering merit, offering to these souls merit, as it's called in India and Tibet, that will help them evolve in a better way. So, and there are also souls who will hang out after they leave the body because they're people they love whom they want to just make sure are okay, or when a spouse or a sibling or a parent or a child is suffering and calling on that spirit, they will hang around for a while and eventually, kind of let you know that they've moved on. I have a friend who wrote a book. The reason I'm telling you this story is because I trust the person who is the source of it more than I normally do, people who write these books. But anyway, this book is about her brother. It's called The Afterlife of Billy Fingers, and it's available on Amazon in case you're interested in this kind of literature. It's quite enjoyable and interesting as a description of the after-death realms. So her brother was an alcoholic who was hit by a car on the streets of Miami, and he'd had a difficult life. He certainly hadn't had a career, often hadn't had a job, but was also a very loving and kind and kind of magical person who'd been very close to his sister. A few days after the funeral, he appeared as a subtle presence at the foot of her bed and told her that he was going to describe exactly where he was and what was happening. So, and he he came every night for several weeks. He told her to take dictation, which is how the book happened, and described what his guide said to him, the journeys they took him on. And at a certain point, he said that he would not be coming back, that he was moving to a subtler plane. And he left her with a very exalted sense of possibility and love as the driving force behind every movement of the soul. And, you know, these stories, I find, are really quite helpful to us as we consider our future in the after-death realms. Another piece of geek lore, often the experiences we have of clairaudience, of clairvoyance, of psychic sensing, for I know some people on this call, actually, who have these abilities, and very often these are kind of offered to us or channeled through us by guides in the astral realms. And there are also practices in traditional tantra where a practitioner will consciously form a relationship with a spirit from one of these planes, from the lower or mid-astral plane, by making offerings and other meditation mantras and other meditation practices. And sometimes these spirits will help with healing and sometimes with more manipulative practices. My guru, who had definitely done his time in the world of Indian sadhus, where a lot of this, this kind of practice of spirits takes place, often said that some of his contemporary Indian wonder-working gurus were actually working with disincarnate spirits. And, on another note, animals can sometimes sense spirits. If you've ever seen a dog who suddenly growls and barks and sniffs the air, very often that's why. And, in shamanic traditions in Southeast Asian cultures, there's a very respectful attitude towards spirits of different kinds, and people will make offerings to them just as a normal part of life. Let's take a deep breath in and exhale. Another deep breath in and exhale. And once again, be aware of awareness. Be aware of awareness. Be aware that everything that I'm saying and everything that you're thinking and everything that you see is made possible by this profound, all-pervading, aware presence that both knows your experience and holds it, both makes experience possible, and also connects our mind to the great mind. Beyond the lower astral realms are mid-level planes inhabited by more advanced spirits, more advanced astral souls, and which are also possible for former humans to experience and spend time in. And it's also one of the places where those subtle beings whom we call guides or angels tend to live. One of the properties of the beings of the astral realm is that they are shapeshifters. They have the ability to take anybody. They can create their own astral food. They create costumes. They create places. They create vehicles through which they travel. They have astral brains, and according to Yukteswar, they are able to sense through every part of their astral body. And they also, he says, feel emotions even more acutely than we do, particularly the emotion of connecting to suffering beings on the physical realm. The experience of compassion is very much a natural property of the souls in the astral realms. That said, there are also beings in those regions who are not so helpful, and I will say a little something about them. So the sense of being guided, of, you know, that feeling that I think every one of us has had from time to time, or the sense of intuition, is, according to Yukteswar, it's very, very often coming from one of these guides. Of course, we never know whether our intuitions are coming from within the personal knowing or from the collective unconscious. But if you're in the habit of asking for help, whether you ask for help from God or from a particular deity, or just ask for help, there's a very good chance that you're being who you're contacting is one of these guides. And the guides are very often, I've come to recognize, emanations of deity energies. For instance, I have a very strong experience these days of a feminine presence whom I experience as being connected to the goddess whom I invoke in my meditation and with the mantras I work with. And what I came to realize at a certain point, maybe she, quote, told me, is that what I'm experiencing is not the full goddess, which is much too big for my human frame to contain, but an emanation which is with me a lot and unfolds for me a lot. And I think that many of you have such experiences also, that, you know, that our connection to, let's say, a spiritual family connected to one of the, you know, the very high planes of existence, connected to a form of the absolute, or one of the great deity forms or Buddha field forms, that their emanations are very, very present to us when we call them, or sometimes even when we haven't. And I also want to say that when you contact a helping presence, when you ask for help, or even when you contact a relative, you know, who's passed away, make sure that you do it in a practice context. You know, in other words, that you, so to speak, purify your own field, whether through chanting or meditation or mantra, so that you really can open up to the guidance that is at the highest level. And the other sort of amazing truth that we can discover in as we become more familiar with these ideas and these experiences is the way in which we can actually feel into our peer groups, our soul groups, and the ways in which they do influence our life now and in the future. And I want to tell you a story that comes from the Hasidic tradition, similar to that story that I told last week, that, you know, I find very moving, like many of these tales. So the story goes that there was a man in a small city in Eastern Europe who was trying to find a husband for his daughter. And he used to visit a study hall, which, as you may know, is a feature of traditional Orthodox Jewish life, and where there was a young man whom he saw reading texts who had emanated a very beautiful aura and who was famous in the study hall for his brilliance and for, you know, his knowledge of the texts. So he thought, you know, this might be an appropriate husband for my daughter, and he told his daughter about the young man. And then one day he saw this boy get up from the table, from the desk where he usually sat, and he saw that the boy had a club foot and a very deformed gait. And he thought, oh, this guy is maybe not a good husband for my daughter. Who knows what else is wrong with him? And he went home and told his daughter that, decided that she shouldn't marry this guy. And the daughter, to his surprise, became completely stubborn about it. She said, "No, this is my husband. This is the man I'm supposed to marry." And finally, the father gave in. The wedding was held. It was a beautiful celebration. And before the wedding, the father and his new son-in-law had a conversation, which is, of course, traditional between fathers and prospective husbands. And the father said, "You know, I really had hesitated to let you marry my daughter because of your leg. And my daughter was the one who insisted that we get married." And the young man said, "Let me tell you the backstory here." He said, "Your daughter and I have known each other in subtle worlds for a long time. And when I was in that realm, I was able to see her future life. And I saw that she would have a serious accident in childhood and that she would be deformed. And that as a result, she would never get married. So I, in that subtle realm, using the creative power of that realm, I took that deformity on myself. For some reason, this story is very emotional for me, and I think it tells us a lot about how much more there is to understand about the blessings that we receive in our lives from beings who love us from other times and other realms. So maybe you'd like to take a moment and just feel into that story and consider the mysterious situations in your own life where you've sensed that something was being given to you that was a form of grace that saved you, that helped you, that you didn't bring on yourself. And realize how much blessing we actually receive from parents, from friends, from so many beings, so many places. In the upper realms, the upper astral realms, which are often called the God realms, there are beings who have extraordinarily beautiful bodies and very exalted souls. And these are the realms, the heaven realms, which are, of course, famous throughout literature. And obviously, my father's house has many mansions, as Jesus said. There are many, many heaven realms. And in the Indian tradition, every deity, and these are described in the mythological books, every deity has their own heaven realm where their devotees go after death to spend time kind of as a reward for their good actions and their devotion before once again taking another body, because these heaven realms for human souls are temporary. But as Yukteswar says, as we evolve, and apparently this takes many, many cycles of life on a physical planet, we spend more and more time in upper-level worlds, and we begin to learn some of the skills which are available in the subtle realms, including the skills of actually creating physical events and physical bodies, which is quite a mind-blowing idea. It's very much a part of the lore of these realms, that in the upper astral realms, which are called causal realms, where great sages, great saints, have go to live, go to be. They exist in light bodies, bodies made of light, even after they've become fully enlightened. They exist in these realms as beings of joy, and especially doing what the Buddhists call bodhisattva activity, helping beings on earth in very powerful ways. And among these sages are beings whose, let's say, cosmic job it is to be vehicles through which the source, you know, perhaps the great goddess, perhaps that being that other traditions call God, but that intelligent love energy, which is the source. These beings have the cosmic job of transforming subtle energy into matter, into planets, into beings, into emergent species. And again, you can take this with a grain of salt or two, but it's a very interesting way of looking at the evolutionary process, which is that, you know, although the system is clearly self-generating, that there is also the possibility of, you know, actual new creation coming forth into the world, whether in the form of ideas, memes, or apparently in physical form. And again, these stories are told in the Puranas, in the mythological books, about sages who have this capacity to create physical universes. Obviously not something that you would do every day. But I want to read you a passage from my guru's autobiography, which is called The Play of Chit Shakti, The Play of Supreme Consciousness. One of his features of his practice was that he had very many meditation experiences in which he visited these subtle worlds. And he, when he says these worlds exist, he, when you heard him say how they, you know, describe these worlds, you could really feel that he'd been there. So this is called Visit to the World of the Siddhas, the Perfected Beings, the worlds that Yukteswar describes as, he calls them Satyaloka and Brahmaloka. Swami Muktananda calls the world he knows Siddhaloka. So in this world, and he's describing a world of very much sages from his tradition, in this world I came upon a fascinating path, and following it I saw forests, caves, flowing streams of pure water, white, blue, and green deer, white peacocks. The atmosphere was very calm and peaceful, and there was a beautiful blue light everywhere, such as you would see if you looked at the early morning sun through a piece of blue glass. There was no sun or moon, only light spreading everywhere. When I arrived, I felt such strong waves and impulses of Shakti that I knew intuitively that I was going to have the darshan of the ancient seers. I started to move around with the speed of thought. I saw many siddhas, many perfected beings, all of them deeply absorbed in meditation. Each one was in a different mudra. None of them looked at me. Some had long, matted hair. Some were clean-shaven. Some were sitting under trees, some inside caves. I saw the great seers I had read about in the Puranas. I saw Jesus. I saw my guru, though he was in Ganeshpuri, where he lived. He was here, too. Each siddha had his own abode, made in styles I had never seen. I found that I now knew everything. I recognized the seers and sages of ancient times. I saw many yoginis sitting in their various divine mudras. I was fascinated by this realm. I didn't feel like leaving. I went on roaming in a state of peace and love. It seemed that something unknown was guiding me. And at this moment, a siddha, whom I didn't know, said, "You've just seen Siddhaloka, the world of siddhas. Here live the great saints who have achieved liberation. There is no hunger, no sleep, and no awakening. One eats joy, drinks joy, lives in joy, and continuously experiences joy. Just as a fish sleeps in water, lives in water, eats in water, plays in water, so the inhabitants of Siddhaloka abide in joy. So, as we did last week, let's use the power of imagination to conceive of a world populated by sages. Imagine that as you sit here, as you sit in your seat, and again, if you're walking or driving, perhaps you'd like to listen to this at a time when you can be seated in meditation. So anchoring yourself in your posture, or you can also lie down. Imagine that your subtle body, your soul body, rises up from your physical body. Walks across the room and sees there a door. Just look at the door. Notice what it's made of. And then open it. You'll see in front of you an elevator. Enter the elevator. The elevator begins to climb and it rises. You see that the sides of the elevator are transparent and it seems as though you're rising through clouds, through a deep blue sky, into a realm that is completely beyond this one. The elevator stops and you walk out and you find yourself in a place where everything you see is made of jewel-like light. Perhaps it's a visual experience. Perhaps there's simply a feeling of subtle presence. Begin to sense that in this realm, in this region, there are beings whom you may have known personally in other lives, whom you may have admired. Perhaps some great sages like Ramakrishna or Ramana Maharshi or Anandamayi Ma of modern times. Perhaps very ancient sages, beings from different traditions, beings whom you may not recognize. But notice how all of them, each one of them, is emanating a radiance of freedom and an ecstasy that you may taste and take in. Allow yourself to be drawn into connection with one of these beings, or simply allow yourself to move through this infinitely subtle realm. Let go of the thoughts you have that this isn't real, or I don't belong here, or I'm not quite getting it, or any of those things. And just allow yourself to roam or sit and inhale the Shakti, the energy, the light, the presence of this place. As the breath flows in, feel that from all sides you're taking in the blessing and the liberated energy of these beings. And with the exhalation, you're allowing your body to open to the sense of blessing. Please feel free to sit. In a minute, Deb will put on the goddess chants for us to listen to as we close. And I'd like to ask you to listen to this call another time. There's a lot of subtle information in it, a lot to take in. And there's also, as you may have experienced, an opportunity to receive some of the blessing that flows through us as we tune into these higher realms. Have a beautiful week and feel free to open to the sound of Craig, Press, and Ananda singing the Devi Prayer.
Namaste. Jagadambe Janam.